KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
What I love about this cardigan is that you can see there's holes in the sleeves where he would stick his thumbs through.
We tested to see whether or not the division of housework and sexual desire and attraction were co-organized by traditional gender roles, and that's what we found.
Coming from the computer industry, we're kind of computer data geeks, so we kind of like data. We like the sharing of information.
That's what we're going to do this morning on Weekday, share information. Jeff Rakes, head of the Gates Foundation. We're also going to find out about some of the interesting objects of our city that perhaps paint its history for us. We're going to talk about that a little later. And we're going to talk about housework and sex and how they match up. A little more data there. That's coming up as well. But we start with the Gates Foundation and setting clear goals, picking the right approach, measuring the results to get feedback and refine the approach continually. That's their goal. That's what Bill Gates and Jeff Rakes have been talking about in their annual letter, and we just wanted to go into a little more depth on that. Jeff Rakes is the chief executive officer of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Until early 2008, he was president of the Microsoft Business Division, oversaw the information worker, server, and tool business, and Microsoft Business Solutions Group. You helped give us the GUI for the graphical interface for Apple.
Microsoft Office in that background.
Yeah, all that stuff. Well, you're a data person.
Yeah.
So this makes sense that you folks would be looking at getting measurable data.
Well, I think it's very important. I think one of the things that you learn in business is that in order to succeed, you have to continuously improve. In order to continuously improve, you have to have clear goals and measure your progress against those goals. And so we try and apply that same level of discipline in our work at the foundation.
Is that new?
No. I certainly feel like that was in place when I came in 2008 as the CEO, but I would say that you have to continuously improve how you continuously improve. You have to keep working on those measurement systems.
Do you have examples from current work that you're doing where an improvement in a tool, in a way to measure information, has changed your approach?
Well, I think one of the most important is the work that we're doing on polio eradication. Bill and I were in Nigeria in September of 2011, and during that trip, we saw some really innovative work done by one of our partners, the World Health Organization, that involved using geographic information systems, satellite mapping, in order to transform the micro plans for the vaccination teams. And what we discovered is that there are, in fact, now that we've implemented that more broadly, we've discovered that there are more than 2,000 settlements in northern Nigeria that just even weren't on the micro plans for the vaccination teams. In other words, they were being consistently missed. And so there's an example. Another thing that we did was we equipped the vaccination teams with GPS tracking. So we actually got a chance to see where the vaccination teams went. Did they make it to the village? Did they cover all the households in the village? And that helped to improve the performance of the vaccination teams.
How do you know that, if they've covered all the households? Do you have the number of the households in each village as well?
Essentially, we can compare the satellite mapping of the villages and the households to the actual, and then overlay the GPS tracking onto it. So we see, did the vaccination team miss half the village because there was a stream bed going through the middle of the village and they weren't able to get to that other side or something like that? So we can basically see that. The other thing that we discovered, which was fascinating, is that it was commonly the case that the polio cases were occurring on the boundaries of the local government areas. Think of it as on the boundaries of the counties. So essentially what was happening is that one government area was saying, well, that village is not my responsibility, and the other one was saying, well, that village is not my responsibility, and so then they were just being missed. So that use of information, satellite information, that use of data helps give us insights that continuously improve that campaign.
So in that example, what's the next step? You have the data, but then you still have to convince either of these entities to take responsibility for that village.
Yeah, that's correct. And so essentially what you do then is you work with the government areas, the health officials, in order to ensure that all villages and all households in the village get covered.
The polio case is almost a case of complete success. You're down to the last three countries.
That's correct.
And how many cases in those countries total?
Well, there are a few hundred cases each year. So we're 99% of the way towards eradicating polio. The problem is if we don't go to 100%, what will happen is polio will come back and we'll start to see tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of cases a year. So the key thing to do is to have the resolve to complete the job. If we do that, not only do you eradicate polio, which will save the world roughly $1.2 billion per year in polio campaigns, but and of course those resources can be diverted then to other health issues like malaria, but also by focusing it on polio, you can raise the routine immunization system. In other words, the ability to do vaccines for other diseases, pneumonia, diarrhea, hepatitis, so on and so forth. So we're trying to use the polio campaign not only to eradicate polio, but also to raise the quality of routine immunization.
Jeff Rakes is the CEO of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And we're talking about every year Bill Gates and all you put out a letter assessing where you've been. So we're looking at these assessments and of where you are and where you're going, because we're close to the Millennium Development Goals mm-hmm. of 2015. Mm-hmm. Those were put in place mm-hmm. with the idea of achieving certain goals. You had data, you had steps you were taking.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Where are we at?
Yeah, we've made great progress in certain countries. They will hit some of the goals. I mean, there were eight core goals, things like eradicating extreme poverty and hunger, improving maternal health, reducing child mortality. At the Gates Foundation, we're in particular focused in on goals like extreme poverty addressed through agricultural development, as well as reducing the child mortality. In the annual letter, Bill shows that since 1990, we've gone from roughly 12, 14 million under 5 deaths per year down to, close to 7 million. And so there's been real progress. The sad thing is that still means that there are 14,000 children who die every day, and most of those deaths can be prevented. And so we are continuing to work on that.
Really, you feel that you all look at those numbers and you say, you know what, we can get it to zero or as close to zero as possible. And you think the data, having the data, is going to get you there.
Absolutely. I can tell you of the 7 million children who die every year under the age of 5, roughly 40% or about 3 million die in the first 28 days of their life. That's neonatal mortality. A lot of that can be addressed through better maternal care prior to the birth, during the pregnancy, and also in those first 28 days. Another 1.2 million children die of vaccine-preventable diseases. In other words, if they had been vaccinated for pneumonia or diarrhea or other types of childhood diseases, the kind of vaccines we take it for granted for our kids, if we can get those to the poor kids in the developing world, we can probably prevent another 1.2 million of those deaths. And so that's how we use data. That's how we use information to guide our work.
You started this. Bill Gates started his letter by talking about the steam engine, the Bellman steam engine, and the micrometer, which allows you to measure very specific changes. Are we talking about, when you're talking about getting data, are we talking about new tools?
In many cases, we are talking about new tools. One of the most tough stories for me was when I visited India approximately 3 years ago. I met a little girl named Arshi. Arshi was probably at that point in time about 9 months old, and she'd contracted polio. That was, of course, very sad. And I was sitting there with her father holding Arshi, realizing that if we could have figured out a way to get the new bivalent vaccine, a new type of vaccine for polio out, perhaps even 6 months earlier, maybe Arshi would not have contracted polio. And so that is part of what gives us a sense of urgency to get these new tools done. We do very innovative things. I mentioned the geographic information system. You'd be surprised to know that we can do the genetic fingerprinting on the polio virus anytime a case has occurred, so we can see where that case originated. For example, 3 or 4 years ago, there was an outbreak in Tajikistan. That was from a case in a certain part of India. So in other words, we can see where it comes.
Somebody had traveled.
Yes, somebody had traveled, and Tajikistan had let down their guard in terms of polio vaccination. So those kinds of tools really help us focus. We monitor the sewage systems for wild polio-type virus. That is another innovation that really helps guide our work.
Jeff Rakes is our guest, CEO of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. You know, you told that anecdote of a person, an individual.
Hershey.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, how does that affect you after a while?
Well, it's very tough. I will always carry that image with me. In my mind, I can tell you exactly where I was standing. You know, I can picture Archie's father. I can picture Archie, of course, who, 9 months old. She's a little shy. It's very sad. And, just recognizing that father, he doesn't realize the challenge ahead raising a little girl with polio. And, then to think about our work and what we can do and the importance of sharing that story as a sense of urgency that inspires our people, our partners, to continue forth on this campaign. That's the kind of image that I carry in my mind.
You mentioned the different ways that you're working on extreme poverty, mm-hmm. which is that I don't know how you guys view it. Do you view extreme poverty as the fundamental basis by which these other problems arise, mm-hmm. or are the other problems, disease, lack of water, the reasons why extreme poverty
persists? Well, of course,
they're
very interrelated, and once again, we would go back to the data and information. There are roughly 1.3 billion people in the world who live in extreme poverty. The definition is they live on a dollar or less per day. Of those 1.3 billion people, roughly 70 to 75% of them are in rural areas, meaning they're dependent on subsistence agriculture. So that is why one of our largest programs is agricultural development. If you can figure out a way to help transform the agricultural productivity of those families, then that leads to their own food security, that leads to their ability to afford health interventions, and ultimately a mechanism to transform themselves out of extreme poverty. One of my favorite stories there was when I was in Kenya in 2009, I visited a dairy farming region. I met a couple named David and Lucy. David and Lucy were supporting 8 family members on a farm of about 4 acres. They had 1 dairy cow. We were part of a project that put in place a chilling plant for these dairy farmers. In other words, now they had predictable market access. They were able to sell their milk on a daily basis. They weren't able to do that before. At the end of the conversation, I said to David and Lucy, what were their aspirations for the future? What did they look forward to? And David answered and he said, I'd like to rebuild our herd to 3 cattle. What happened? Why are you doing only have 1? He said now that they had a predictable market for their milk, what they could do is sell 2 of the cattle to afford for their oldest daughter to complete her degree in hotel management in Nairobi, at the university in Nairobi. This is a couple that is living in a mud hut with 2 sets of parents and 2 daughters, and their aspiration is to use their farm income for their daughter to complete a degree in hotel management. I've seen that with coffee farmers in Uganda. I've seen that with vegetable farmers in Ethiopia. Everywhere I go, I see that these subsistence farmers, if you can transform their productivity, they will use that to invest in their kids.
Of course, you guys get criticized for supporting GMOs in various places, genetically modified crops, operations. How do you incorporate that criticism into looking at the data? In other words, are you committed? Do you always have feedback loops? How do you approach those criticisms?
Certainly, the important thing is that we look at what are the right choices for farmers to have and then let them make the choice. Actually, a very small percentage of our work involves support of GMO breeding.
The significant and yet you get criticized.
Well, I know. We get criticized. I mean, we're going to get criticized for a number of things. But at the end of the day, we have to believe in how we can help provide these farmers the right choices. And so if you can provide a drought-tolerant corn through a certain type of breeding and give them that choice, that is ideal, especially if they can have the choice of the conventional breeding as well as some of the biotechnology breeding. So giving these farmers the choices is what's important.
I get that. But the problem with the criticism is about biotech, what's its impact beyond the field, you know, over to the next field. I just wonder when you, in terms of measuring data, is that part of
absolutely.
The data it's, you measure?
Regardless of the type of breeding, safety is extremely important. And so we try and make sure that all of these countries that are doing various types of breeding have good safety policies in place, that they use the data, the information to inform their breeding practices.
Have you guys, do you have examples of where you've been able to, that data has shifted your approach to an issue?
Well, certainly with the issues of climate change and what that's going to mean in terms of stress on crops, both sometimes it's actually surplus water, sometimes it's shortage of water. One of our best examples is sub-1 rice. What that means is submergent-tolerant rice was developed with the International Rice Research Institute. Rice, although it grows well in water, if it's flooded, if it's submerged for an extended period of time, it will die. We worked with IRRI, the International Rice Research Institute, to develop a rice that can survive underwater for up to 21 days. That is now being used by millions of farmers in India. And so we use our data on what's important to guide the investments that we make with our partners in developing these new types of crop varieties.
So the other things you're doing and the other things that was written about in this letter is teacher evaluation and looking at master teachers and mentor teachers as a way to provide continuous feedback and educate teachers, make them better. You guys can provide money for that, but you're always facing budget cuts at these school district and at the school district level. How do you feel you are ensuring that the data gives you programs and people still in place?
I think there are two important things. One is you want to make sure that our country understands the importance of investing in education and maintaining those resources, and where possible, increasing the resources. But as you point out, we're in a time of tight budgets. And so it's also important to use data and information to guide the funding to the things that have the highest productivity. We know that teachers have high aspirations to be the best that they can be, to be the best for their students that they can be. The challenge has been that there haven't been great feedback systems that provide teachers the information that they need, that the evidence that they get can support their professional development. So our work is actually oriented toward how we can help teachers on their professional development, and that's why we emphasize multiple measures. Evidence of student learning, which sometimes is represented in testing, is just one component. You want to have good observations by peers and principals or administrators. You want to have the appropriate use of student voice. So I think sometimes our work is misunderstood. We actually believe very strongly in multiple measures of supporting teachers in their evaluations and professional development. And in addition, we think the key is really to support them on how they grow and develop.
This is a circuitous way of getting to this question. There's a lot of criticism and response from Congress over what the NIH is allowed to study and how they study gun violence. Other people said, the reason the data was rejected in the first place because they were poorly constructed studies by which to understand gun violence in America. So I want to get to charter schools by that way. Do you think you have good data, and is there enough spending on the charter school issue, which Gates Foundation has supported, to dispassionately evaluate its impact? Because there's a lot of conflicting reports out there about whether charter schools work, whether they don't work.
Well, that's absolutely right. And I think the key thing is that our public school system is extremely important, and charters will be a small percentage of the overall public school system. What is their role then? Their role is to be able to have the ability to try some things, to innovate in some ways, to show what can work for students. And effective charters should be supported. ineffective charters should be shut down.
But who's paying for those studies? Where do we have those studies to know how they're working?
There's a lot of different, you know, I've seen studies from Stanford University. I've seen studies from universities in Michigan.
Yeah, me too. Do you feel that you're getting good data on charter schools?
I think we're getting better and better information all the time. And I think what it's showing is that there are certain best practices that happen in charters, just like there are certain best practices that happen in the non-charter part of public schools. You know, you basically want to identify what those best practices are and spread them.
So personally for you, you guys write this letter once a year. You look at what's happening. For you personally, what's your goal for this next year?
Well, the number one thing we're focusing in on is the progress on polio eradication.
And for you personally, that's the...
Yeah, it is the number one goal of the foundation. And as the CEO, it's got to be my number one goal. I'm also very actively involved in our agricultural development work. I was just in Geneva last week to meet with the president of Nigeria, along with former Secretary General Kofi Annan, on the work in agriculture. So we have high priorities in Nigeria, Ethiopia. We work with a organization called Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa. But, Steve, part of what I do also is to try and make sure we're increasing our capacity for impact. So, in other words, my job breaks down into supporting our program work and supporting how we do our work. And this, for example, how we do measurement is an example of what I need to do in order to support how we increase our capacity for impact.
Yeah, I was struck by how you were a young boy on a farm. You and your brother figured out how to use a computer to run your farm better. Here you are today.
Yeah.
All right, great. Jeff Rakes, I appreciate it.
Great. Thank you very much, Steve.
Jeff Rakes is CEO of the Gates Foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. This is Weekday.
When it comes to heterosexual married couples, who has more sex? Couples where household chores are split evenly? Or couples that stick with more traditional division of labor? We'll find out in a minute. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Christine Palmer and Associates, presenting antiques and collectibles shows in the Northwest for more than 30 years. Next show, February 2nd and 3rd at the Puyallup Fairgrounds Showplex, with 400 vendors and thousands of items from the 1880s to the 1970s.
47 degrees and cloudy in Seattle. Expect rain at times through the day with a high of 48. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:27. What would be on a list of objects that best represent Seattle? The Space Needle, Jimi Hendrix guitar, and the giant ground sloth, of course. We'll get to that in 20 minutes.
If you're a part of a heterosexual married couple, I am, how do you divide up the housework? It has an effect on your sex life. Yes, I attest to that. Question then, so how should the work be divided? What's better? Should couples stick to their traditional tasks? Traditional, I hope you put in quotes, like cooking and cleaning for women and yard work and home repair for men, or should they divide up the chores equally across the gamut? Katie Sewell, You're newly married.
I am.
Do you guys divide up your
tasks? We do.
You go out and do the yard work sometimes?
Well, we live in a rental, so we both leave the yard work to somebody else. But the answer might surprise you about how to divide it up. The University of Washington just released a study that's answering that question of how to divide up the housework to have a good sexual relationship. Julie Brines is co-author of the study and associate professor and associate chair of the Department of Sociology at the University of Washington. And I asked her to explain the results.
What we found is that in couples who have a traditional division of labor, and we define that as married couples where the husband does more of the traditionally masculine chores, those include anything from yard work to auto maintenance, painting the house, bill paying, and driving. And the wife does more of the traditionally female tasks, which include cooking, cleaning, and scrubbing floors and that kind of thing, that they actually have more sexual contact in an average month.
Did the study find out why that would be the
case? Yeah, we tested a couple of ideas for that. What motivated the study is that there was some research that was published about 4 or 5 years ago that showed, or suggested at least, the opposite, that men who do more work around the home And I think a lot of people associate that with the kind of work that women do, get more sex. That was the headline. And what struck us about that were, well, two things. One was we weren't sure about the evidence that supported that claim. And we also were very intrigued by the kind of model of the way in which the relationship between sex and housework worked. Basically, sex was something that women exchanged in return for housework or help around the house. And we wanted to see whether or not, in fact, housework was done or not done according to a very different logic, not a logic of exchange, but in ways that were tethered to ideas about what it means to be masculine and feminine, how to enact that, express that in everyday behavior. And so what we did is we tested to see whether or not the division of housework and sexual desire and attraction in heterosexual marriage were co-regulated or co-organized by traditional gender roles. And that's what we found. And then we tried to test some explanations for that. Well, maybe it's because when he does more work around the house, be it very traditionally masculine, the wife is happier, he's happier, they have greater marital satisfaction, and so that translates into a more active sex life. So we tested that idea, and we found out that that didn't explain the relationship. We looked to see whether or not the relationship we found was limited to people who embrace traditional gender roles. So it's not only what they do, but what they believe that leads to this result. And we found that beliefs about gender roles also didn't explain the relationship. So even people who embrace very non-traditional, non-stereotypical ideas about what men and women should do, if they find themselves behaving in ways around the home that reproduce the stereotype, they also tend to have more sex.
And you came up with a number of how much more sex they're having, 1.6% more, is that what? Or 1.6 times more?
1.6 times, yeah.
How do you get that number? Where's the number come from?
Well, what we did is we used our data to estimate models. And then we, based on all sorts of information about the couple, not just how much time they spent on housework, but their education level, their age, all sorts of things, everything basically we could find out about them. And then we said, okay, if we factor in information about every other characteristic about the couple, and the only thing that we vary is how much time the man and the woman spend on male and female tasks, respectively, what would happen, what would we predict as far as the number of times they would have sex during a month if he did all of the female work, in other words, the core tasks of cooking, cleaning, scrubbing the floors, that sort of thing, and compare those couples to couples where we could imagine that he does none of the female tasks. And if you do that kind of comparison, and there are couples in our study that are like that. We actually observe couples where that's the case. But we use these models to predict what would happen if you had these two kind of polar opposites. And that's where we came up with this 1.6 number, that for couples where he does none of the core tasks, in other words, he shies away from any traditionally female work, that couple has sex a little over 1.5 times more per month than their counterparts where he does all of the female work.
Speaking with Julie Brines, who's an associate professor and associate chair of the Department of Sociology at the University of Washington in Seattle. And she's co-author of a study looking at how the division of household chores affects a couple's sex life. And they found that couples holding traditional roles, like a woman doing the cooking and a man doing yard work, for instance, actually have more sex than couples that share the responsibilities. What are couples supposed to take away from this information?
Well, there's a lot more in the paper than the headline. We also find that marital satisfaction is highly related to the amount of time that men spend doing housework. So, you know, while couples who have very traditional arrangements are having more sex and they also have increased sexual satisfaction. The results are a little more ambiguous when we sort of look at satisfaction with the marriage overall. And we also know that when husbands resist doing work around the home of any kind, that leads to a lot of marital conflict. So one shouldn't take away from this research the idea that, well, men should, you know, eschew doing any of the dishes or, you know, the laundry or any of that and just focus on raking the leaves on the lawn. it just so happens the more time that they spend on traditionally masculine tasks, the more sex the couple will have. And we find that that's, like I said, sort of ambiguously related to marital satisfaction and conflict.
Were you surprised at what you found?
You know, I wasn't. I wasn't, and I don't think my co-authors, and I'd like to mention the lead author of the paper, Sabino Kornrich. He's a former graduate student in the Department of Sociology at the U, and now at the Juan March Institute in Madrid. And I have another co-author, Katrina Loop, who's also with the University of Washington. We, the three of us, were not all that surprised by what we found, partly because there's abundant research out now that shows that the division of housework, at least, is still regulated by some fairly traditional ideas about gender, that people find themselves, even though they may embrace very egalitarian views about masculinity and femininity, they still tend to behave in ways that are consistent with very stereotypical roles. So we knew about that research. And we also found that this notion that behavior in one arena of married life somehow follows some different set of rules than behavior in another arena, a little odd. I mean, we knew that the division of housework didn't follow an exchange logic. So why should the trade of sex for housework follow that logic? So we weren't surprised. We thought it reasonable to think that sexual activity, especially in heterosexual marriage, would be regulated by these same deep-seated attachments to who people, how they think about themselves, and what they respond to in the other person.
Were children taken into account in the study?
Meaning the
whether
number
or not
of kids.
Or not people had them.
Yes, we did.
What about how they were taking care of them?
One thing that our research doesn't look at is childcare. So our definition of household chores is limited to non-childcare tasks. We did look, though, at differences among couples depending on, you know, whether or not they had children at home, how young the children were, and controlled for those and found the same relationship. In fact, if anything surprised us, the basic relationship didn't surprise us, but if anything surprised us, it was the robustness of the results. The results, you know, we thought of everything under the sun that might explain what we found. And after investigating nearly everything, we found the same relationship. It continued to surface. And that's one of the reasons why we think it's so deeply connected to this belief about appropriate behavior for men and women, which gets translated into sort of a catalyst for sexual attraction.
Has any study looked at homosexual couples? I know that this is a heterosexual study only.
I don't know of any study that has looked at the types of chores that partners in same-sex couples do. And I don't think there's a study that looks at the division of household labor in the way that we do for same-sex couples. There is some research on same-sex couples and the division of household labor that's very interesting. And it shows that gay male couples kind of manage the housework in ways that are different from heterosexual couples and from lesbian couples. Gay male couples tend to have a very rational approach to the division of household labor. And so the person who is sort of occupationally more senior or earns the more money, has the larger paycheck, is going to do less work around the house. What's interesting about this, there's still a gender component, however, because both partners, from the research I'm citing, both partners, especially the one that doesn't do the housework, is complicit in sort of concealing the amount of work that his partner actually does to other people. Sort of suggests that, well, you know, it might be difficult if people knew that my partner was a house husband, you know, that this may challenge some beliefs about his masculinity. So I will downplay the extent to which he does that work and what it means. For lesbian couples, they're very much focused on doing equal amounts of work and monitoring their own and their partner's behavior to make sure that everybody does sort of an equal amount. So that's what we know.
Julie Brines is the associate professor, associate chair in the Department of Sociology at the University of Washington in Seattle, and she's co-author of a study that's looking at the division of household chores and how it affects a couple's sex life. Thanks so much for coming in.
All right.
This is Weekday.
939. Seattle in 25 objects in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Laird Norton Wealth Management, an independently owned wealth advisor committed to balancing clients' financial well-being with their personal fulfillment, providing customized financial planning, investment strategy, and trust management services. On the web at LairdNortonWM.com.
Contemplating significant change, women on the front lines, immigration reform, your word to describe this modern America.
All I have to say, finally.
Liberty. It's about humanity.
How about inequality? Is that how this moment will be remembered? To look at the gap between the wealthiest and poorest Americans. Next time on The Takeaway from Public Radio International.
That's this afternoon at 1 right here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Broadway Center for the Arts in Tacoma, presenting Ed Asner in a one-man show as Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Friday, February 8th. Tickets at BroadwayCenter.org.
47 degrees, cloudy and rainy in Seattle. Forecast calls for rain at times through the rest of the day with a high of 48. Overnight, rain at times with a low of 43. And tomorrow, Friday, partly sunny with a high of 50. It's 9:40. I'm Bernard Ouellette. Wounded former Representative Gabrielle Giffords spoke today to a Senate Judiciary Committee to urge tighter gun control laws. We'll have more on that in 20 minutes.
The BBC had a series, The World, The History of the World in 100 Objects. So our intern, Alexandra Garrettin, whose last day is today, so she thought she'd wrap up big. She thought, what about some objects that tell us about our region, the history of Seattle, the history of Puget Sound in 25 objects? That's what we are attempting. Knut Berger is a local journalist, the author of Space Needle, The Spirit of Seattle. So you were spending some time with a major object that says something.
That's right, a major artifact.
A major artifact. And Lorraine McConaughey is a historian at the Museum of History and Industry, MOHI. You have many objects.
And we're in an object.
And you are in an object that says something about our region. So we have a little bit of tape from this, from one object, and then I will ask you questions about it. But Alex checked out some of these objects, and at the Burke Museum, she met up with paleontologist and curator Liz Nesbitt to talk about the first item on our list and, frankly, my favorite.
We're looking at the skeleton of a giant sloth. It's a ground sloth. It didn't hang in the trees. It walked on the ground. And it is about 12,000 years old. And it was found at SeaTac. They are big. They were somewhat ungainly. They looked a little like big bears. And I think the reason we have the complete specimen is when they were doing renovation at SeaTac in the early 1960s, they came across some fossil bone. They came to the museum and they talked to the curator at the time, and he said, well, can we excavate it very carefully? 12,000 years ago was the end of the last ice age. The ice, which had completely covered the Puget Sound area all the way to Olympia, was melting. So it was a time when there was grasslands here, there were probably very few trees, there was still lots of ice in the mountains, but because the ice was melting, it was leaving lots of soil, and so it was probably very fertile, but cold temperate valleys. Something like northern Canada today. So at the same time, there was a whole suite of animals. But of the big animals, there were mammoths, there were mastodons, there were definitely saber-toothed cats. What happened to all these very large mammals at the end of the Ice Age? They were all over North America, and they all disappeared in a very short time. There are two ideas. There's one old idea that the humans came and killed them. The other one, which seems much more likely, is the climate change was very rapid because the ice melted very rapidly, and the animals simply couldn't keep up with the change in environment. And so some people use that as an explanation of why things are going to go very wrong with us now. We're causing a dramatic climate change in a very short time.
Before there was the mossback, there was the giant ground sloth.
That's right. In this case, Meg the giant ground sloth. They actually named it.
How about this idea from both of you? Just overview first. I mean, you look at these 25 objects. We're going to try to have all of them on the web. We have a Facebook page where we're asking other people to think about what are the objects in their lives that say something about the region. What do you get from these 25 objects overall? What jumps out at you?
Well, it was fun to contemplate the list and find things that would be representative of the sort of chronology of geography and culture over time. The ground sloth was, of course, a great place to start because the early inhabitants post Ice Age found in 1961 they were putting in a light standard on one of the runways at SeaTac, and it was also interesting because Thomas Jefferson was the first scholar to really look at these bones of sloths and mastodons. He thought they might still exist. And he thought, judging by their claws, that they were lions, which is why they call it Megalonyx jeffersoni, is what the name of this particular. And of course, it turned out they were herbivores. This particular one was, they were able to test samples of the soil and peat around it and do carbon dating and whatnot and determined it had been eating alders. And what I love about that is here's this moist, chilly climate. All of us can imagine a boggy stand of alders, and the sloth is sort of digging there. And of course, it just kind of represents the environment that the first people moved into here. And then it was fun just to kind of take it down through the highlights of Seattle history.
Well, Lorraine, actually, Alex came out and talked to you, went to Mohai about this next item. It was made in 1856 while Washington Territory settlers in the Seattle area were under siege from Native warriors. And hear what you guys talked about.
We're looking here at the petticoat flag. It's a flag that was sewn by the women settlers of Seattle and King County as they came into the North Blockhouse during the attack and then the siege after the attack in January, February, and March of 1856. They sewed this flag from petticoats and baby blankets. There are 13 stars on the flag. The stitchery is very funky. This is not a Betsy Ross flag. This was sewn in the dark and the cold by political women making a statement identifying this tiny settlement of 20 buildings and 50 settlers with the very, very far away Washington, D.C.
Why were the first peoples, the natives, attacking the settlers at that time?
They were rising up against the terms of the treaty, the treaties that were negotiated, and I would put that word in quotes. This is a hasty and dismissive and rude kind of negotiation that had taken place over such a short period of time. As Native people realized what those agreements amounted to, that they would be put onto small reservations where they couldn't pursue their way of life and so forth, a substantial subset of Native people throughout Washington Territory created a coalition across many language, many political, many cultural groups to rise up against settlement and to restore what had been before. It's a very defensive kind of war, the treaty war. So the attack on Seattle is part of a long siege of people fighting for ideas, fighting for their way of life.
You know, it's interesting to think about these objects that so many stories come with every object. And when you thought about these 25 objects, this is what you do. You are, as a curator, you're a historian, you're looking at these objects. Was there a narrative stitching them all together? Did anything link them all in some way?
It's inevitable that any string of beads, 25 beads, will be a mnemonic for a particular narrative. And we could have strung 25 different beads and come up with a different mnemonic. Listeners will have their own beads that they're going to want to put on this string. But you bet, there's a narrative. Skip and I didn't choose all of these. So there's a bit of a serendipity to the narrative.
Uh-huh.
But I think that would be fun to explore on Facebook. What is the story that these 25 objects string together to tell about Seattle? And what stories do they not tell? There are no boats on this list.
Is that right?
Yeah.
There's no boats.
No boats, no sites and structures, no books, one work of art. It's not wrong. It's just a kind of your mileage may vary sort of list. But every object is filled with stories. The sloth that Skip was talking about aids us in this colossal act of imagination to envision the time that he talked about so eloquently.
It really does. I also like these Chinese shoes, the imported Chinese shoes, 1880s, Wing Luke Museum. I mean, there are many intertwined stories going on in our region, some of them not spoken of or not narrated for many years and then return. These ideas return, like the picture brides. We talked about it with an author about the picture brides that came to the West Coast. Are there new stories emerging when you start? You guys are unpacking at Mohai, for example. Are new stories emerging when some object comes up that you haven't really thought about in the past? You said, oh, what's this?
Well, I think the most recent object, artifact in that case, it's something created by the hands of humans, that's on display right now is the Kindle Fire. And, you know, collecting doesn't end. History doesn't end. So, you know, it's 2013. What's the history of 2011? Those stories are unpacking themselves, and they're crying out for collecting initiatives of oral history, of photography, of documentation, and of objectification, because it's these objects that are so powerful in conveying to our eyes, without having to read a lot, they speak for themselves.
Well, I think historians are a little bit like the ground sloths patrolling the swamps at the face of a melting glacier, and that time is moving on, and there's this interesting zone where something isn't quite history yet. You know, the zone of contemporary events and history, and watching that change take place, and so. You know, on this list, you have something like Kurt Cobain's cardigan sweater. Okay, that's not that old. Is that really history? Well, it is. It is
sure.
Some history. Or a Starbucks cup. Or and then finding, the narrative thread. We can agree that these things have meaning. Now, whether they'll have meaning 100 years from now is a different question. But so I think patrolling that sort of swampy zone is a really interesting exercise. For me, the one item on this list that is kind of new and different was the sculpture that inspired the shape of the Space Needle.
Well, you've written about that.
Well, I did. And the Channel 9 documentary in my book, which came out the same time, that was the first time this had ever been reported, that there was a specific object that inspired the unique qualities of the Space Needle that have made it an icon. So it's kind of an icon's artifact. And it was a work of art, a work of abstract sculpture that inspired Victor Steinbrück.
Our intern, Alexander Garrettin, was inspired by the BBC's 100 Objects that told the history of the world, to look at 25 objects that tell the history of Seattle, the history of this region. She wanted to go out with a bang, since she's going to go back to college, get herself a little master's degree. That'll be your object, Alex. Or you should maybe take a tote bag to remember us. So here's Dan Hagedorn. He's the senior curator at the Museum of Flight, and Alex went down to Boeing Field to talk to him about one of the airplanes that put Boeing on the map.
If you had to pick a single artifact that represents Boeing, Seattle, the U.S. war effort in World War II, the B-17 in all of its flavors would certainly be very central to that discussion. Boeing took a leap of faith, basically bet the farm on what they called the Boeing Model 299, which was the granddaddy of the B-17 with four engines. And to say that it was the wow factor of its day is to radically understate the case. And when they rolled that aircraft out here at Boeing Field in 1935, one of the reporters said, "My gosh, it looks like a flying fortress." And that's where the name of the aircraft was basically born. 2,300 B-17Fs were built right here on Boeing Field. At one point, they were averaging as many as 6 aircraft per day. I doubt if we'll ever reach the volume that was reached by Boeing during World War II, simply because of the force of circumstance. I once asked my mother, she was a young woman during World War II, "Tell me, what is your most lasting impression of the war years?" And without hesitating, she said, "We all pulled together." B-17 was an airplane. It was an inanimate object, but it united the community. We had been attacked. We were going to strike back. We were going to defend democracy, and we were all going to be pulling together.
Stan Hagedorn, the senior curator at the Museum of Flight, talking about the B-17, one of 25 objects on a list we put together to think about what tells us the history of our region in Seattle. Knute Berger is local journalist, author of Space Needle, The Spirit of Seattle. Lorraine McConaughey is historian at the Museum of History and Industry at MOHAI. B-17s, that's a pretty iconic story there that he told.
It's a fantastic story, and it was well told, I think. Each one of these artifacts and objects is a basket, a container for stories. And the B-17 is a wonderful story about the mobilization of defense industry, which includes the things that Dan has said, but it's bigger, and that makes it so strong. Boeing's workforce at the time the Flying Fortresses were being rolled out at that rate was more than 50% female. It was more than 10% African American. Those were major sea changes in the way that Boeing organized industrial work in that factory. And in the B-29, the B-52, all the way up to the 787, you see the learning how to organize very complex manufacturing processes in repetitive manners rather than the 1930s version of building an airplane up from scratch, where I do it all, you know, if I were a guy and a member of a union and a journeyman. This is a dramatic transformation during the war, and the B-17 lets us talk about that. Rosie the Riveter,
that's
the B-17.
She just popped up in my head as soon as you said that.
Lorraine wrote a wonderful book about how it's important to look at actual documents because they tell you so much, the stains on them, the dog-eared pages. Artifacts are the same way. If you ever get a chance to see a B-17, you should. And one of the things that really struck me in seeing an actual, you know, B-17 up close is the men who flew these planes were fit, small, shorter than we are, thinner than we are, young. The physical object itself tells you a story about the people and the conditions under which they flew these missions. The average 6-foot-tall, bulky 18-year-old of today would not fit in a B-17, at least comfortably. And so it gives you a sense of the different times, the different scale, and the youngness of these men who flew these missions. They were kids in body chronologically.
Yeah. All right, give me a quick flavor of two more objects. The glue pot of 1889.
Well, the Great Fire of 1889 is sort of an ironic moment in Seattle's history. In June of 1889, Ellensburg, Spokane, and Seattle burned to the ground. The decade of the 1880s was this colossal period of upgrowing as the Transcontinental Railroad arrived and statehood arrived, and these little cities, these big towns, grew higgledy-piggledy. And the result of that is that you have factories next to hotels, next to restaurants. So the carpenter's shop in which the glue pot sat, where John Beck forgot about it, he was melting this hard glue made from hooves in order to glue furniture together, and he neglected the pot, and it boiled over down onto the wood shaving, started the fire, burned, you know, 30 blocks of downtown Seattle, almost all of the wharves. No one died. Happened in a day. It's a fantastic little pot, and it's filled with stories about immigration. This Swedish immigrant was brand new to Seattle. People blamed him for his lack of knowledge of how to live and work in an urban space. It was a story about the poor social planning and urban planning. There were no zoning. There was no professional fire department. There was no fire department machinery worth using to put out this fire where, you know, we depended on the water pressure coming down off the hill and whether the tide was in. Seattle rebuilt itself after the fire. As Paul Dorpat has said, it created a clean canvas.
Yeah. All right. Seattle and 25 objects. We'll have a build out on our webpage. You can look at pictures of them. Also at Weekday on KUOW, there's some pictures there, and you can add your own objects to that list and help us sort of understand the stories behind the objects as well that tell the history of this region. Lorraine McConaughey is a historian at the Museum of History and Industry. Thank you.
Thank you.
Knute Berger is a local journalist. See you on Friday, I guess, right?
Yeah, you bet.
All right.
Thanks.
And Alexandra Garrett, our intern, put this together. It'll be on the web. And then now, thank you. Head off for college with knowing that you accomplished this fine goal. and we'll see what happens in the future. We'll hear a couple more pieces of tape next hour on Weekday.
/9:59 As the U.S. prepares to allow women in the military to serve in combat, what might we learn from the history of female soldiers in Canada's military? We'll take that up with our Canadian correspondent Vaughn Palmer just about 5 minutes from now. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Cancer Care Alliance's new Proton Therapy Center, a partnership with ProCure Treatment Centers. SCCA's new Proton Therapy Center allows doctors to precisely target cancerous tumors while minimizing effects on surrounding tissue.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.